Hello, beautiful people. Welcome to this week's episode of the Montpelier Happy Hour here on WVEW 107.7 LP Brattleboro, your community radio station. I also want to thank BCTV for sharing the video version of this show with PEG stations around Vermont. And today, I want to welcome our guest, Representative Tristan Tolino, who, as I was joking with Tristan earlier, usually when I introduce Emily, I get to say one of three reps from the town of Brattleboro. And today I get to say Tristan Tolino, one of the three reps from the town of Brattleboro. So glad you're here, Tristan.
Delighted to be here. Sometimes I refer to myself as one third of Brattleboro's team, or, you know, one of three. Like we have our little litany when we are in shared spaces together or when we're following up one another. So, but I'm super thrilled to be here with you.
Well, thank you for being here. And just so listeners know, I'm hoping to touch base with as many Windham County lawmakers between now and the end of the session as is possible. So thank you, Tristan, for stepping forward and being the first. Now, you serve on the House Committee on Appropriations. You also serve on the State Workforce Development Board. And so I think that's what we're going to be talking mostly about today is workforce and budget, which two big issues in Vermont. Now, normally when you and I have talked about workforce in the past, it's kind of been generally, and it's about workforce issues in Vermont in general. But today we're going to talk about a specific report that came out, I believe, end of March, beginning of April?
Actually, a little earlier. It came out in January.
Okay. Wow. Totally missed it. But anyway, it comes out every year and it takes a look at how the actual state workforce is doing. And I will link to it in the show notes. But Tristan, give us the lowdown. There's not so much good news in this report, which is not something you want to say about the state workforce in a state that's having workforce challenges.
No, it is not. And let me just start. I'm not going to spend much time on the non-state workforce part of this, but I'm just going to set one piece up in the background. When we talk about workforce, what does that mean? Or the labor force, what does that mean in big numbers? And what is the macro trend of what's happened in the last 5 years? Everyone knows that the pandemic was very disruptive, that the post-pandemic hiring world has been different. And, you know, like we read a lot probably in the news or hear a lot about it, but it's not necessarily grounded in, well, what does that really mean?
And so I would interrupt quickly to just say, and it doesn't always mean the same thing for every workplace. For some workplaces, it might be training. For some things, it's barriers. People can't get transportation. So it can be a different reason depending on what you're talking about.
That's absolutely right. And so the background here is that in January of 2020, pre-pandemic, Vermont was in the middle of a multi-year challenge of having, you know, quite a few job openings. I think at the time it was something like 10 or 11,000 job openings in the state, and very, very low unemployment and an aging demographic. So there were fewer people in the workforce. When we talk about in the workforce, we have the two numbers. One is the number of people who have jobs, and that's the employed category, and then the unemployed. And there's different definitions of unemployed, but this is unemployed and looking for work within the last year. So that's a more typical measure of, so not people who've given up or have opted out, you know, that there's a larger number of people who fit that category, but the people who are sort of in the hunt for a job but are currently unemployed. And so in January 2020, the snapshot is that we had about 7,000 people on unemployment in that category of unemployed and about 344,000 who were employed. So our total labor force was 352,000. And then the pandemic shifted that. And so as we started to come out of the shutdown phase, really the summer and early fall with you know, people may recall that we had the variant start to show up in the fall. And so we were starting to get like back, and then we weren't. But by November of 2021, that number of the total labor force had fallen from 352,000 to 337,000.
Oh, wow.
And the number of employed individuals had fallen from 344,000 to 327. And so there was a 3,000 person increase in the unemployed level, but an overall drop in the number of people participating in or the labor force participating in work in this metric. And no one knew how long will that persist? Like, is this permanent? What's going on? And there was a lot of data that was suggesting that people who were near retirement or who had perhaps overstayed an eligible retirement window because they left the work or because they needed to financially were opting out and not necessarily planning on returning. So there was, we knew that there was a that was one population that was especially affected by the risks of working in the COVID, early COVID era. And of course, because we had a we have an older than average state, that it was also disproportionately affecting us. But we also started to get a sense that, you know, the frankly, the federal relief programs that helped many, many, many Vermont families navigate the crisis also helped keep the economy going. And so the economy started to recover. And by December of 2023, we basically were back to the same labor force numbers we'd been at in January 2020. So we're back up to 352,000 in the labor force, back up to 344,000 employed, and back down to 7,500, 7,700 unemployed. And so what you see is that, if you will, like the trough of the peak pandemic has now been filled back up, and we're back to where roughly where we were. So that's the backdrop on one part of it. And then the other backdrop then is that anecdotally still, you know, people are saying it's very hard to hire. And why is that? Well, because the economy has been doing well, because of our aging demographic, we have one of the highest numbers of open jobs still for available workers. And so it's like 2.5 jobs for every available worker, which I think is in the top five, if not top one or two. So even though we've recovered significantly, there's still a lot of demand for workers and many, many, many businesses across all sectors that are struggling to find the help that they need. And that brings us to the kind of unique employer that is the state of Vermont. And we're one of the three or four biggest employers in the state. I think, you know, UVM Medical Center, University of Vermont Medical Center is first, and then University of Vermont is second, and GlobalFoundries may be bigger. I don't think GlobalFoundries is bigger than the state, but we're in that top five for size. So because I've been paying attention to workforce and had sort of a committee responsibility to be thinking about workforce adjacent issues, I actually read this report that was issued by the Department of Human Resources. It's an annual report that they generate that's looking at the culture and demographic changes within state government. And frankly, I was both appalled and extremely worried after reading that report. And I'm going to share, hopefully, background on why both of those things, you know, because they're different. And I'll start with the concern, right? The concern is that the state of Vermont can't be just any employer. And the reason why is that where we are seeing deficits in the state systems and in the state workforce are places that profoundly impact services that very vulnerable Vermonters desperately need. And, you know, and I know that's true in a hospital too. Like, if you don't have enough nursing staff, but they can hire travelers, and it's expensive, it's problematic, it's not ideal, but as an example of the both the fiscal costs of this and the sort of lived reality of this is that last summer, when we were going through a phase of crisis with the emergency motel program for our homeless population, there was a huge pressure on the frontline staff who work in Economic Services Division of the Agency of Human Services, DCF, who handle the calls and the case loads of those individuals. And people were calling and being asked to wait 2 or 3 hours or you know, or literally spending all day to try to get to somebody who could help them. And that division had 29 vacancies in it, and they had not been able to hire for it. And so not only is it like not having those 29 people spread throughout the state is hugely impactful, you know, in terms of the lived experience of people trying to call in, but then it an incredible pressure on the human beings who are left in the system, who care, who want to do their job well. They know that they're the front lines of support for vulnerable Vermonters, and yet they're just being crushed under the weight of that. Another example is the unemployment division of the Department of Labor, where I'm sure people have seen various glitches in the mainframe system that have caused benefits to be delayed and other things, which, again, the unemployment system is a crucial support for people who are vulnerable. If they're out of work seasonally, or if they're out of work, for short term, or just recently laid off in some way that's, they don't know how long that's going to last. Not having that benefit that they're entitled to, that they've paid into when they were working. So it's not even that they haven't contributed, but they need that. And when there were problems with the system, that department has to step up and do work differently because of the computer system being malfunctioning. But that department has had 20% of its staff not hired for the last couple of years. And I asked the commissioner, what are you doing differently to try to address that problem? Because that seems like a pretty big problem. And he basically said, we're spending, the $30 million to get a new computer system, but that won't be ready for 3 years. And he acknowledged that one of the factors is that those individuals were being put into forced overtime, meaning they aren't allowed to leave their job. And, if you're somebody who's processing claims, it's a day job, you're expecting to do paperwork, and then you're told you can't leave. You have to work until we say you're not working. That's not the kind of environment that fosters longevity. In fact, it fosters turnover. And so the way out of that gap is not obvious. But again, not only is it impacting our ability to address claims quickly when there are these gaps in the computer system, but it's also putting enormous pressure on the individuals who are left in that system to do their jobs under extreme pressure. And so we're seeing that throughout state government. So I think it's something that should concern all Vermonters, because we want our government to work well for us. And, especially when we're making those investments. And the macro right now is that for 2 years running, we have been short roughly one of every 10 positions in the state. There are 1,072 positions open across state government. And in some places, it's significant and profound in the Department of Mental Health and in the Vermont Veterans Home. It's huge. The Veterans Home has a wait list of qualified individuals and a wing that they cannot open because they are so dependent on travel nurses and they can't hire. And, it's like multidimensional impacts that are happening. They can't bring people in who deserve to be there, would thrive there. They have a great environment for them, which would also free up other housing elsewhere for people who need housing. And to the extent that they're dependent on travelers, it's causing huge budget pressures. And I'll come back to that when we talk about the budget. And if I don't, please prompt me to sort of talk about the way that workforce is putting pressure on the budgets in a way that's kind of invisible for most Vermonters.
Okay. You said it well, but I want to go back to the veterans home and just make sure listeners really hear that the veterans home has open beds that it could actually put people in and get them care. And they have a waiting list of people who qualify for those beds, but because they don't have the staff, those beds are just staying open and the people are just staying on the wait list. And that kind of makes everything else in the system sticky.
That's right.
Or constipated even.
And that's exactly right. And it's also true at the state psychiatric hospital that they have a wing or two that they can't open for the same reason. I don't remember off the top of my head what the number is for the Vermont Veterans Home, but I do for the state mental health hospital that it's more than half of their shifts on direct patient care are being run by travelers.
Oh, wow.
So this is, the backdrop, where I want people to understand this is actually all of our problem. It puts fiscal pressure on us because state government is unable to meet people's needs in the way that it's been designed to do. whether that is shortages in the Act 250 permit office, whether that is shortages in the call center, in many, many different ways, it shows up in a way that's impactful for Vermonters. And so it's right for us to look at this. And then I also want to be absolutely clear, the governor, for lack of a better word, is the CEO of the state. The legislature is responsible for the laws and for passing a budget. And the governor is, as the chief executive officer of the state, is expected to execute on those laws and the plan, in his case, he has agreed to. You know, when he signs the budget or allows it to become law, then he's agreeing that that's the plan, the strategic plan, if you will, that he's going to work within and try to execute on. And where this crisis goes to a whole nother level, in my opinion, is that I'm not seeing, frankly, the accountability from the governor as the chief executive officer to say this is not okay. And we have to change what we're doing. We have to reimagine what we're doing. We have to adjust. And I've said this, and I think that this is anecdotally, but I think unquestionably true, that a CEO of a company of 8,000 or 10,000, you know, we have 10 to 11,000 employees. So let's say 10,000 employee company. If a CEO of that company was losing 4 out of every 10 new hires within the first year and was unable to hire for a 10% vacancy rate, they would be out. It would, that no CEO would be safe in that context. And my concern is that that's actually the environment we're in right now. And what I have heard from the Commissioner of Budget and Finance, from the Commissioner of the Department of Human Resources, you know, from the Commissioner of Labor, whose statutory job is supposed to include being the workforce leader for the state of Vermont, all representatives of the administration in explaining their plan. What I have heard is that their idea is we'll just, you know, we'll just keep trying to hire for the positions that we have. And not what I said to them all is I said, to me, it feels like a 5-alarm fire. And what I'm hearing from you is incremental improvement is just fine.
Interesting.
And, you know, and I want to give you a few more data points around the state workforce that I think tell that story. You know, so I said nearly 4 out of 10 are leaving in the first year. This is a direct quote from the Human Resources Department. For fiscal year 2023, nearly 75% of people who voluntarily left did so in the first 5 years of their working for the state. And nearly 40% occurred in the first year of employment. But even, you know, 10% don't make it past 30 days, and over 26% don't make it past 6 months. And, you know, this it's hugely significant. There is something wrong. It's beyond just, you know, and again, like that, it's true that we are collaboratively responsible, legislature and governor, for the providing the budget, providing the laws, but the governor has not responded in any way publicly to say, I want to do a better job as the chief executive officer of the state of Vermont to make sure that this is the best place in the state to work, that we are, you know, fully staffed, that it's competitive and people want to work for us and do this good work that we are all committed to doing. And he's not saying that. And he's not asking anything new of his leadership teams. He's not asking for change. And I think the evidence is very clear. And if you remember, I set up at the beginning that the labor force in the state has largely returned to what it was pre-pandemic. But here's another metric from the human resources. The number of unique applications, unique individuals who've applied to state jobs, fell from almost 19,000 in 2019 to about 12,500 last year. So a 50% drop in the number of unique applications in 5 years. And what that means is that also they're having a harder time kind of pulling together a highly qualified pool to choose between. And so nearly 70% of all of the job openings that they're trying to hire for are receiving fewer than 10 applications. And they're also having trouble where they're having an unusually low number of people accepting the job offers when they make them. And I think there are some good reasons for that, and I'm happy to explain it. And it's tied to the budget pressure, but also I think tied to where the process is taking so long. It takes on average 70 days for Vermont to hire for an open position.
Yeah,
And
and if you've
so
applied to 14 jobs and you've heard from five of them, yeah.
that's right.
Yep.
That's right.
So I think what I'm sitting with, and we have just 5 minutes left in this first segment, Tristan, is, we talk on the show about stories and the stories we tell. And one of the stories, at least I tell about state government, is that those are pretty plum jobs. They have a strong union. They tend to have strong contracts. They tend to have decent pay compared to other jobs in the state. We could talk about wages in Vermont probably too at some point, but they have fairly good wages and they tend to have good long-term benefits like
Yes.
insurance or pensions or something like that, which is really plum in a state like Vermont. And so I'm kind of sitting with, what do you mean they're not getting tons of applications? And what do you mean they're having a hard time with retention, which everyone focuses on with workforce, the hiring side. But retention is just as important because it costs money to bring people on board. It costs money to train them. You have institutional knowledge you need to pass on. It's a big deal to retain someone. So that's what I'm sitting with. My jaw's a little bit on the table, just a little bit.
Yeah, I asked the Commissioner of Budget and Finance. I said, "Look, I said you're essentially the CFOs of state government. You see all the budgets across state government." And I said, "And what we know from lots of very good research is that the training costs of new hires, that losing somebody and having to retrain somebody for their position, that it's at least 1.5 times more expensive than retaining them to train somebody new in the position because of lost productivity, because it takes other people off of their work stream to have to train somebody. All of those things add up to like a 1.5 plus cost." And so, the numbers that I just read to you about what's happening in that first year of employment, what that means is that for all of the places of churn, they're actually absorbing, huge productivity losses and if not direct extra expenses. And last year, the turnover rate overall was 13%. And there was only it, they go back 20, they go back to 1998, so 25 years.
Okay.
And that was the highest turnover rate since 1998, except for 1 year, which was last year, the year before, I mean, the year before. And
Wow.
so, but basically you've had the two highest rates of turnover, 15 plus percent 2 years ago, and then 13% last year. But if you think about that, I mean, that means that, over the last 5 years, who knows what percentage, some of it will be the same jobs turning over. So it's hard to directly know, but I mean, it's quite possible that 25% of state government is brand new, and that's a huge productivity drop. There's just no way around that. And again, if this were a CEO situation, the board of directors would not be able to sit by idly and say, "This is fine, it'll turn around eventually." That's just would be unacceptable. And here we are, and the governor is not being accountable for trying to figure out how to avoid the situation. And what I think is happening, and I'm a progressive Democrat from Brattleboro, Vermont, I have a
You have
perspective
opinions.
that is, I have opinions, but I honestly think that this is a place where the ideology of the government is more of the problem than it is the solution is rearing its head. That there's an that it's and I want to stay just on this side of sounding like a conspiracy theorist here, but Grover Norquist many decades ago would talk about starving the beast, and make it, that if the government was under-resourced and underperforming, then people would want to privatize government services to get better performance, and that would shrink the size of government. And what it feels like is that is happening in Vermont, but in a way that is invisible to Vermonters, who think, well, he seems like a nice guy and he was good on issue A, B, or C, and that's all I can remember about him. And they're not paying attention to the fact that as a leader, he's not actually accountable. For what his primary responsibility is actually to steward state government in the way that we've all agreed to do, and that's not happening. And so it's extraordinarily disheartening, and that's why I said at the beginning, I'm both sort of disheartened and distressed, and also concerned about the larger crisis. But part of it is simply the lack of ownership and leadership of the governor on what is his primary responsibility. And I'm not sure yet, where to go with it, because it's very hard for the legislature. We approve positions, but they do the hiring, they do the job descriptions, they do the management and the coaching and mentoring and all of the things that matter in workplace culture. The workplace culture is the responsibility of the governor. It is not the legislature. We can't legislate that. The union can negotiate around the larger issues of compensation and process, but the culture is the responsibility of leadership. And that falls to the governor. And I just don't think he's leading here. And his people, literally their answer, I could send it along to, but it's available on YouTube. But when I
Yeah,
ask these
send it along. I'll
questions,
put it in the show notes.
yeah, I will send it along, because it's even a timestamp to where I've asked some of these questions. And they the Commissioner of Finance, Budget and Finance, when I asked him, have you evaluated what this turnover rate is doing in terms of those kinds of hidden costs, he said no. And when I asked the Commissioner of Labor, like, from your perspective, what are you doing differently? And he's basically said nothing. And when I asked DHR, what are you seeing? They did not have a meaningful response that said, yeah, we get this. This is a five-alarm fire. They just were like, well, we think we're trying to do something on training people when they come in. But what that shows me is that across these different parts of state government, they are not approaching this as a crisis. I'll give you one more example. We did a ton of grants for the pandemic, and then last summer for the flood, to affected businesses through the Department of Economic Development. And so for the flood, we used a system that we had built during the pandemic era to help support small businesses. We have funded with federal ARPA dollars, which is the emergency response to the pandemic dollars that Leahy secured for Vermont and other states, but for Vermont. We funded seven positions that were limited service, meaning they're going to expire at a certain time frame because the funding source is temporary and the job is theoretically temporary. They've only been able to hire two of those positions. So they have five open positions, and those jobs, the time limit on them ends in October. And they had two applications, neither of which were qualified, one of which was not in country, one of which was some, on the West Coast. And that's it for these five positions. But they have more
Interesting.
than 500 grants that they're required to do the follow-up for, and they don't have the staff to do it. And I said, so what's your game plan? And I said, wouldn't it be better? Would it make sense for us to give you permanent positions that might be more attractive to people to apply for, because they're not applying for a job that's going to disappear in 9 months? And I
Good
was
point.
told, no, we don't want any permanent positions for this. I said, but you have a statutory and federal, grant responsibility to do this grant evaluation work. How are you going to get it done? And the commissioner said, well, all of us will have to do it, including the commissioner and the deputy commissioner. And what does that mean? It means they're not doing the other things that are their primary jobs.
Sorry, the thing that's interesting about these particular five positions, and then we do have to hear from some underwriters, is you, the legislature, made the offer of making them permanent. And given the conversations around how it's likely we're going to have more floods and more crises, and we need to build resilience into our systems, you would think they'd want to jump at that because it's like long-term planning. I'm Monday morning quarterbacking here. But hold that thought, Tristan. We need to hear from some underwriters here on
Absolutely.
WVEW 107.7 LP Brattleboro, your community radio station. But Tristan and I will be back with this conversation in a moment. Welcome back to the second half of the Montpelier Happy Hour here on WVEW 107.7 LP Brattleboro, your community radio station. If you're just joining us, I'm the host and producer of the show, Olga Peters, and I'm speaking with Representative Tristan Tolino from Brattleboro, again, one of three reps from the town of Brattleboro. And we've been talking about workforce issues, particularly how they pertain to the state. And before we jump back into our conversation, Tristan, I must say that the views and opinions here on the Montpelier Happy Hour are those of the host and the guest, and not the platform, not state government, not your committee members, not the vaulted halls of Montpelier's state house, nothing, just ours. So thank you, Tristan, for being here today.
Thank you.
In the first half, we were talking about the report that came out earlier this year that specifically looks at workforce issues within state government. And one of the things it really showed was that the state government, not only does it have a hiring problem, which a lot of employers in Vermont have right now, it has a serious retention problem. And your concern is that you feel the governor, as the CEO of the state, isn't giving this enough attention. And for me, what I was hearing is it sounds like even the folks in the departments, the deputies and the commissioners and the secretaries and all those folks are operating from this place of overwhelm. Makes total sense. But also, from what I was hearing, a lack of empowerment that they maybe even didn't feel they could make some big broad changes. Am I hearing that correctly? How would you
Yeah, and
characterize
this
it?
is I'm gonna I would say yes, I think that that's true, and you know, and I referenced what feels like potentially an ideological part of this, and we can get into this more when we talk about the budget, but
Okay.
the governor was explicit in his budget order to ask for no more than 3% increase. And then the final budget that he offered, I think, had a 3.6% increase in his framing of it. And I want to come back to that. You know, he has said over and over and over again that state government can't keep growing, can't keep growing, can't keep growing. And so there's a belief system there. And so when the administration presents a budget, that's their position on how state government should be staffed and funded. And they send out their political appointed leaders, the commissioners, secretaries, to defend that position. I mean, it was both surprising and not surprising, right? That the commissioner of the Department of Economic Development would say, no, we don't need new positions because that's the formal position of the governor. You know, they had already taken that position in their budget. They don't need new positions. They're just going to try to hire, you know, continue to hire for the positions that they already have, even though the on the ground reality is that it's almost impossible to imagine that they'll be successful because the jobs are expiring because they haven't been successful.
Oh no. Yeah, listeners, just so you know, we have had some Wi-Fi issues today, so bear with us. Hello, listeners. We are back. Thank you, Tristan Tolino, for restarting your computer and changing locations and everything, so we can go on with our conversation. My concern right now is what the lack of state workforce might mean for people who are trying to access services. That for me is the biggest concern. But I'll put this question to you, Tristan. We're laying a lot at the governor's feet right now, but how do we know that's at the right place?
I'd love to respond to that because I've used the language of the CEO or the chief executive officer. I mean, it is literally the executive branch in our system of government. So it is you know, a constitutional responsibility. Now, you could say, well, he's obviously doing that, but that doesn't mean that he should be able to single-handedly do more than the workforce, you know, at large will allow him to do. And I think that the question then becomes, if you have a multiple year track record of things not going well, how do you respond? And if you respond by saying, well, we hope that it will get better in the future, but we're going to continue to do the same thing, that is a leadership decision. They are choosing one path by not choosing to innovate, not choosing to bring that to us. The legislature, we do a lot, we prescribe a lot, we react to a lot, but we are not the ones running the day-to-day of state government, and we don't have the information to run state government. But if the governor came to us in the budget cycle and said, we have a fundamental problem with our job design, with our work culture, with our attractiveness to the the workforce environment that we're in, and we have five suggestions for how we're going to turn that around. And it's not going to be a one-year thing. It's not a one-year fix, but these are the five strategies that we have that we think are going to meaningfully make a difference. And but they're going to cost money, or they're going to require these changes. Then we would then have a conversation about whether to spend the money, make the changes. But what they came to us with was nothing. And so if you are comfortable with that level of turnover and that level of vacancy, enough that you don't want to change any of the systems that have led to that point, that is a leadership decision. And it is one that only in our system, only the governor can make. To my mind, it's unequivocal that that he is a crucial part of the accountability process here, because of his constitutional role and because of that not choosing to change or choosing not to change is a leadership choice.
Interesting. Interesting. Well, and it makes me go back to what you said in the first half of the show about a potential ideological decision to keep state government small. And I think what I'm sitting with all of that right now is, well, that's great, but if people have need, people have need. And if folks aren't getting their, I'll just pick on the Vermont Department of Labor, if they're not getting their unemployment checks in a timely manner, that really hurts families. And that causes a lot of stress. And the irony is, I think a lot of people have negative feelings about how government doesn't work. And they kind of expect it not to work because, story, story, story. And so I can see how there is a vicious cycle probably happening right now.
Yeah, absolutely. And I will say that it also leads to strange things that can be very wasteful. And I shared in the first segment around the pressure on the call centers and the frontline workers in the housing crisis the last summer. Well, the governor and his team, they have some discretionary spending authority when we're not in session. And they chose to hire a Chicago, I think Chicago-based call center to answer the phones for those frontline staff. Look, you can spin it lots of different ways, but the people who were answering the phones in the call center weren't able to do any eligibility determinations or anything. They were not trained for that. All they could do was take a call. And so the wait time went down from 2 or 3 hours to 10 minutes. So your call was answered, but they couldn't tell you anything. They couldn't actually use the structure of state government in service to your needs. They could simply tell you, oh, you'll need to call back tomorrow, or, like you'll need to talk to your case manager, or, well, there's no information yet available on that particular program, but they weren't doing anything. But we spent $2 million on that.
And if you use the benchmark as did people get their needs met, were claims filed, were checks received, then yes, that becomes a very wasteful
Right.
$2 million.
Right. And so if people are actually needing the trained state worker with the authority and the expertise to use the tools of state government to help them, and what they get is somebody in a call center in Chicago who can't do anything. Is it really meaningful that their call was answered? It's probably better than never being answered on some levels, but it's also worse because their call was answered, and then there's no accountability for the fact that they're still not getting access to the services that they're eligible for and that state government has designed and resourced in an attempt to meet their needs. And that's the fundamental dynamic here of accountability. If the governor said publicly, we're going to put a band-aid on a very bad cut, so that people at least don't have to wait on the phone, and we're going to try to figure out how to make that system help us accelerate their access to services, and we're going to be accountable for whether that works or not. Whole different story. Instead, it was quietly done. People still weren't getting what they needed, but the governor could send his people out in press conferences and say, there's only a 10-minute wait time for phones.
Interesting.
And again, that's a leadership decision. And I think you should be responsible for the consequences of that decision, which is that that did very little, but it spent state dollars on something that was ineffective and was a band-aid on a very bad cut.
How does this conversation feed into the state budget, which if I feel like things move fast this time of year, so maybe my information's outdated, but the state budget has passed the House. It's still sitting with the Senate. It is roughly the same amount of what the governor proposed, but it doesn't put money in the same buckets that the governor proposed.
Yes, you're right about the general arc of where we are in the process, and but there's the story is a little incomplete because the House chose beyond the budget, we passed several pieces of legislation that have significant financial ramifications that are not in the budget itself, but will be if the Senate agrees to some them, they would be in the final budget. So they're not in the current budget. And so that's a little confusing. And so I want to unpack that, and I want to also link this workforce conversation to the budget and the constraints that we're in with the budget. Wish me luck. We'll see how I do.
I have coffee. I don't have popcorn, but I'll do my best.
Yeah, that's right. So let me start with just the high level view of what I just said about how the House approached certain things. So we are the first step in that process, the House is. And after, the governor's first step proposes a budget. Then we evaluate that. We propose a budget of our own. The net total of what we pass for spending has to match the net total of available funds that we have to spend. So we pass a balanced budget, even if we break it up into a budget and a couple of other bills. Those bills, then, if they have spending in them, have to have a matching revenue source so that we're still in, the House position is still spending what is available to spend and no more. And for a variety of different reasons, and I won't go through all of the details of it, but I will name the House 829, which was a housing bill, has a significant new strategy around affordable housing in it. And it inside of that bill, it also has changes to certain taxes that are designed to create the new revenue to offset the spending that the bill does. So if you think of it's a housing bill, but it's like a mini budget in the sense that it has a predicted revenue, we spend that revenue, and then it describes how and why we spend that revenue on affordable housing. If you add that and a couple other bills that we do a similar thing where we have revenue and a policy, a change happening in the bill, if you added those to our budget, we have spent more money and quite a bit more money than the governor. Where we are basically in alignment with the governor is that the day-to-day operating costs of state government, we think that the governor did a pretty accurate job of what those should be, if with one significant caveat, which I'm going to come back to around the workforce. But basically, we've agreed on all of the fundamentals. But we have a very distinct policy difference around the three main buckets: the housing for affordable housing, which is trying to set in motion a 10-year, $1 billion investment in affordable housing. Because we are going to continue to spend significant amounts of money trying to deal with the homelessness crisis, just mitigating that harm and not turn that curve around in any meaningful way if we don't make huge new investments. We've made a ton over the last few years, but they still are not enough to avoid the problem we're in, because we're dealing with multiple decades of underinvestment, and we now have spent all of the federal money that came in through Leahy to support this, and so it has to be state dollars. And we have raised money, raised revenue through two tax mechanisms. One is on high income earners over 500,000. One is on the transfer or sale of property that is worth about $750,000 or higher. So both taxes targeted to people with, people who have higher wealth, who can afford to buy expensive properties and or who earn high incomes. And we use the revenue from that to fund a major investment in affordable housing over a 10-year period. And that affordable housing covers everything from housing for disabled individuals who perhaps their parents are at end of life and, they can no longer care for an adult child with disabilities, things like that. There's not enough housing for them. Recovery housing for people who are working through substance use disorder and need a supportive housing environment. The different tiers basically of vulnerability. Very, very, very low income individuals need a different type of available housing than people who are, for lack of a better term, the working poor. And so this bill approaches that with a significant amount of new resources and a plan that is designed to address all of these different buckets of needs, and I didn't name all of them. There's a 900,000 in there for supporting refugee resettlement programs, which has been really helpful for the Brattleboro area and bringing new workers, new people, new families into our community. Very important in the North, has had a huge impact over decades in the Burlington area. They got started with their federal refugee program decades ago. We're just in the first few years of ours, but it's really important to the future viability of the state, frankly, to have new Americans moving to Vermont and living and choosing to stay in Vermont. So those are all in that bill, but it's above and beyond the base budget. And so the changes that we've made to the base budget, there are some substantive changes. I don't actually think it would be helpful to go into the details on that, but I want to go back to the workforce piece, because actually part of the reason why the budget was as constrained as it was is because the workforce crisis is actually interestingly showing up. So there are 1,075 or 1,072 open positions, those vacant positions. We budget as if the governor will hire for all of them, minus what we call vacancy savings, where we are essentially trying to forecast and agree on a forecast for how likely is it that the governor will be able to get all the way there. So last year in the fiscal year, we ended up budgeting $49 million across all the different budgets of vacancy savings from positions that would not be filled during the year. The governor came in with a proposal for $57 million this year
In vacancy savings.
in vacancy savings. And so this is both inside baseball and really important to understand. There's two things going on here. One is that the vacancy savings lowers the rate of growth of the budget. So when the governor said, I'm budgeting a rate of growth of 3.6 million in the general fund, that was only true because the governor is saying we're not going to be able to hire all of the positions that we're budgeting for. If we were to flip a switch and next week be fully staffed, the governor's budget and the House budget and likely the Senate budget would actually be out of balance. We'd have to adjust it in January because we are all agreeing that it's not possible to get all the way to 100% filled. The question is how much? And the question is, where else is that pressure showing up? I didn't get into this, but what's happened over the last 2 years is that when state positions are open and other people are having to do their work, it triggers a process called request for reclassification, which is a way that managers have to acknowledge that somebody is doing more work outside of their core job responsibility than they used to. And they almost always end up with a higher wage.
Ooh.
And it's step above and separate from the negotiated contract raises that happen over time.
Okay.
And then when they are trying to hire and they're having trouble with not a lot of position and not a lot of applications and a low acceptance rate, one of the ways that they get that acceptance rate higher is that they increase what they call the step that they're hiring people in. So if you have 5 years of experience and you were applying for a job and they were preparing a job offer for you 5 years ago, they might have offered you, this is arbitrary, but say step five.
Okay.
But now, because they know that they're having trouble with that, they may start that offer at step seven. And because without doing that, the acceptance rate would be even lower than it already is, and it's not good. Yeah. And so what that means is that those new hires are on average, the whole lower third of the state workforce has had a significant increase in its pay rates because of the new hiring dynamic and because of these requests for reclassifications. And then a third mechanism, which is called the market factor adjustment, which is like if you're a nurse, working for state government, what is the market for nurses in state government? And so that they set the rates to be competitive. So all of those, what that's done is it's actually invisibly eaten up a whole bunch of the revenue growth that we had year over year before we even start budgeting. So it just the state workforce is going to is all as is costing us more money than it did before because of the way that the workforce pressure is filtering into the system of the people who are here. The governor's not talking about that, but it actually ate up, as far as I can tell, about, see, yeah, about 20% of the year-over-year revenue growth was eaten up just by that pressure, and it's totally invisible. Another 25% was eaten up by the very specific pressure of traveling nurses on long-term care facilities, the Vermont Veterans Home, and the Department of Mental Health. And we ended up agreeing that we had to spend an additional, I think, $23 million just in the mid-year adjustment over what we expected to spend on traveling nurses to help those parts of the system survive this workforce crisis. So we are spending huge money to compensate for this, and it's eating up the available money that we would have to spend on new programs or on redesigns of how things function in order to be more efficient. And so that's my link between what we talked about in the first segment and partly why this is such a tight budget year. And then finally, to come back around to this vacancy savings problem, our calculation is that the vacancy savings by the end of the fiscal year will actually be closer to $80 to $90 million. Governor said 57. It may go as high as 100 million, depending on how bad it gets. We decided in the House to add 4 million to the governor's 57 million and said, you find where it is. We're not going to tell you where to find it, but find 4 million more in general fund savings, because the evidence of the last few years is that that is reasonable. And so it allowed us to put some more resources into some areas that the governor had under-resourced. And, things that, frankly, like the second year in a row that the governor underfunded all of the sort of racial equity programs and efforts. Last year, forgot to protect his own cabinet level advisor from sunsetting that position, forgot to fund the racial statistics positions in his budget, forgot to fund the truth and reconciliation process. Same thing this year, didn't fund the Land Access Opportunity Board. And, so we did things like that where, and things that committees asked us to do. But we left, frankly, several million dollars of requests from committees on things that would be very helpful. $85,000 for a position at the Agency of Human Services that would allow SNAP participants to participate in a federal program called Restaurant Meals, which is Everyone Eats, was our emergency pandemic version of it. But there's a federal program. We can't tap into that federal program because we don't have a position. But we don't have $100,000 to put into that position because of the way that all these pressures are showing up. And so these are just examples of where and how the budget has been complex this year, and where it's not possible to disentangle it from what's happening under Bill Scott's leadership in that executive leadership role.
Thank you, Tristan. We are almost out of time. And I think what I'm really sitting with right now is why it's always so important to have conversations like this, because on the surface, it looks like the budget hasn't moved much, but underneath, there's all this, it's like squeezing the balloon in all these different places. What do you think is really important for listeners to grasp right now? Because it does feel a little bit like, oh my gosh, where do we go from here?
So I have a counterintuitive answer to that. First and foremost is I hope that people understand that there are a lot of really good jobs in state government, and clearly there are some pressures. I don't want to scare people off from, any one of these divisions, but they are good. There are good jobs there. And I do hope that people look at them and let people know from other states who may want to be in Vermont that that opportunity exists. And then, but if you're concerned and you understand and agree with some of the concerns that I've raised, I certainly think it's important to reach out to your local representatives and senators and say, I'm worried about this. This matters to me. I know I've depended on state services or my life, and I understand what that means. Or I have somebody who in my life who does, and I need them to have the right access. How do I help? How can I help you, advocate for that? And then the final piece of it is to let Phil Scott know, to go to his contact page, on the governor's website, and send him an email and say, it matters to me. It matters to me that my friend who works in the family services division is working in an unsafe space because of understaffing. It matters to me that the people that I know who've gone to work in corrections are struggling with the work culture there and are not able to stick in that job. And I'm worried about what that means for the safety of people in the custody of the state. And I'm worried about what it means for, the community members in around Springfield or Newport or place, St. Albans, where there's a larger concentration of the corrections officers. And ask the governor to pay attention. This is purely anecdotal. I cannot verify this, but I was talking to somebody from the state employees union who said that they had a meeting with the governor recently about corrections, and he had no idea. He had no idea how bad it was for them. And, to his credit, when he started to understand how bad it was, he directed his leaders to get on some changes. But it shows me that there's a disconnect in his administration, that he's unaware of the gravity of the situation that the people that he's responsible for are living in. And I think Vermonters should ask him to pay attention, and that it matters greatly that he pays attention and that he asks his people to tell him the truth if they're not telling him the truth, and that he shows that as a leader that he can handle hearing hard information about his responsibilities and can step up. And that is something that needs to come from, everyday Vermonters who can see it in their own interactions and experiences with state government and understand what's at stake.
We are out of time, Representative Tristan Tolino, but thank you for this deep dive into workforce and budget issues. If people want to contact you or find out more about the work of your committee, where can they go?
So thank you. My email is ttolino, TTOLENO. At ledge.state.vt.us, which is a terribly long name. You can go, the state legislature has a website, and my contact information is also there. We're amazingly open, and so all of these resources are widely available. In the case of the Budget Committee, the House Appropriations Committee, all of the budget documents that we look at are available through our website. You can look and see who testified, what bills have moved through our committee, and get a pretty good sense of all of this. And I think, Olga, I sent you an email with some links or some notes that may be in the show notes as well for people if they want to click through. And as I said, I think there's an abundance of information that is available, and I encourage everyone who is able to pay attention and to give us the feedback, and including me. I welcome, some counter opinions or some other insights into what you might think is going on.
Tristan Tolino, thank you so much for being here today. As always, the Montpelier Happy Hour is on WVEW 107.7 LP Brattleboro, your community radio station, every Friday at 2 and rebroadcast on Wednesday. And wherever you subscribe to your podcasts, you can find us there as well. We always love it when people subscribe. In the meantime, have a great weekend, everybody. Take care.